From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Donald Trump transition team was said to be in disarray, but it's sending a singular message in today's picks for his new administration. Outspoken conservatives are welcome. Former military intelligence chief Michael Flynn, who once called Islam a cancer and led lock her up chants at Trump rallies, is slated to become Trump's national security advisor, a pick that does not need congressional confirmation.
However, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions does. He's nominated to become attorney general. And back in 1986, the Senate Judiciary Committee rejected Sessions' nomination to a federal judgeship after hearing testimony that he called the NAACP and the ACLU un-American and that he jokingly called the Ku Klux Klan okay.
The hawkish Kansas Congressman Mike Pompeo, who once tweeted an article that called an Indian American opponent a turban topper, will also need confirmation as director of the CIA.
So there's obviously a lot to talk about as we end this week. And joining us to do so is Maria Elena Salinas, news anchor at Univision. Hi there, Maria Elena.
Hello. Nice to talk to you this morning.
It's great to talk to you. And Rick.
Or afternoon.
What time it is anywhere in the country. Rick Klein is political director at ABC News, and he joins us as well. Hi there, Rick.
Great to be with you.
Okay, so let's start off with Michael Flynn. He's been praised, actually, as a top-notch military officer, but he's also said that fear of Muslims, in his words, is rational. And Jeff Sessions, as we were talking about the AG pick, said after that tape of Trump came out bragging about being able to grab females, that he didn't characterize that as sexual assault. So Rick, let's just start with you. What do these picks mean to you?
Well, first, it means that there's no bait and switch. These are men that accompanied Donald Trump on the campaign trail. They were top advisors throughout. You had to assume they were getting top picks. The second thing it says to me is that Donald Trump doesn't care about the blowback for some of these picks. There were lots of reasons to oppose and might still be to oppose General Flynn, a national security advisor. And then for Senator Sessions, he was already blocked by the United States Senate from becoming a federal judge because of perceived racist comments that he made back in the 1970s and 1980s. So the controversial past of these men is were well known, and Donald Trump has decided to go with him anyway, despite those concerns.
Now, well, you also have Congressman Pompeo, who, again, picked ahead the CIA. He's defended people who did harsh interrogation. He's called them heroes. So that will obviously be questioned. But Maria Elena, I want you to comment on the Secretary of State considerations. These are still unnamed, but Kentucky Senator and former presidential rival Rand Paul said on CNN this week that if Trump nominated Rudy Giuliani or former Ambassador John Bolton, that he, Rand, was going to put up a fight. Let's listen.
I think both of them have been big cheerleaders for the Iraq war and for more intervention in the Middle East. So I hope Donald Trump will pick somebody consistent with what he said on the campaign trail. Iraq war was a mistake. Regime change in the Middle East is a mistake.
So, Maria Elena, your thoughts on what Trump might do with Secretary of State, because he's meeting with Mitt Romney this weekend, and some people say that might be it.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit complicated, you know, to try to figure out what he's thinking about when he's selecting these people and whether or not they're going to go with his narrative. You know, more than that, because we don't know exactly who he's going to pick yet, I think I'm more concerned with the ones that have already been selected. You know, President Obama said it and Hillary Clinton, and there's a message out there that we need to give Trump the benefit of the doubt. But we see some of these first picks for cabinet that have already been selected that are questionable, aside from Ryan's previous. So I think we need to be very concerned, especially with someone like Jeff Sessions. When it comes to the Latino community, he's someone that we really, really need to fear. You know, he's been opposed to every immigration bill that's been out there. He's also been opposed to legal immigration and guest worker programs. And, you know, these are things that we need to take into consideration. There's a message out there of inclusiveness, but what we're hearing is some people that have extreme views and extreme positions that are being selected as cabinet members.
He's not holding back. But Rick Klein, what do you think about the meeting with Mitt Romney this week? I mean, Romney was his biggest opponent in the campaign. He wasn't even running. He called Donald Trump a phony and a fraud. Trump said equally insulting things about Mitt Romney. How crazy is this meeting?
I think it's a pretty clear example to my mind of Donald Trump trying to use Mitt Romney and the reflected glory of Mitt Romney to try to mainstream himself and suggest to members of his own party that he is reaching out. I think there's about a zero chance that Mitt Romney serves in this administration. I do not think he is under serious consideration for Secretary of State, although we've been told otherwise. I think the meeting is a courtesy meeting that's being dressed up, and I think Governor Romney will give him that courtesy. I can't imagine Donald Trump, as unpredictable as he is, turning to Mitt Romney, a man whom he openly mocked and was mocked right back. The two of them, forget a team of rivals, this would be a team of enemies.
Let's talk for a second about the anti-Trump protests that are continuing in Los Angeles. They focused on Trump's chief strategist pick, Steve Bannon, who, when he was at Breitbart News, made it a platform, admitted, celebrated that he made it a platform for white nationalists and others on the far right. So some sound there from protests. Now, the president-elect's campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, said the protesters, quote, degrade the presidency. But, however, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid called on Donald Trump to fire Bannon. Maria Elena, do you think any of these calls to let Bannon go are going to stick at all?
I seriously doubt, knowing Donald Trump and seeing what we've seen from Donald Trump, that he's going to change his mind. He wants to reward those who stuck by him. And let's remember that Bannon was part of the team that actually got him the presidency.
Right.
But, you know, people have the right to protest. And I know they're calling them out. They're saying that they're being paid. And that's part of our democracy. People protest all the time. I'm personally concerned with Bannon because I've been a victim of Breitbart. Mm-hmm. I gave a speech once when I received an award from a university, and I spoke Spanish for part of my speech, and there was something out there that said in Breitbart, there was a headline that said that I began a racial riot. Mm-hmm. So a race riot. So, I mean, I know what we're getting when we hear Bannon. And I think a lot of Latinos are very concerned. People just are concerned with having someone like that so close to the president, giving him advice with such extreme positions.
Well, Maria Elena Salinas there from Univision, but Rick Klein at ABC News, as you said, Trump is giving many of the people who supported him exactly what they want.
Yeah, the way to oppose a lot of these appointments was to beat him at the ballot box. And he is making good on his promises. He's surrounding himself by loyalists. So far, the only major positions he's filled have been by loyalists and people that were with him pretty long time, if not from the start. It'll be interesting to see as he fleshes out the cabinet, if he goes outside of that circle. But so far, this is who he said he would be. And I think you can accuse Donald Trump of a lot of things, and he will be accused of a lot of things. But so far in this appointment process, right, he's been loyal and he's been consistent.
Let's talk about this Ford comment. I want to hear from both of you. Last night on Twitter, Donald Trump took credit for stopping Ford from moving a factory to Mexico. He was wrong. Ford was never going to move that factory, had only planned to move the production of one type of car to Mexico. And in a statement last night, Ford said it did tell Trump it would cancel that one small move to Mexico. But we remember that Trump said during the campaign that he would impose tariffs on American companies like Ford if they moved jobs. And here's what former CEO Mark Fields said this week to our Jeremy Hobson, talking about other factories, but this same topic. Listen.
Well, I think to put things into perspective, the focus that we're moving down to Mexico is to make room for two very important products in the plant in Michigan. So actually, there's going to be no jobs impacted. But when you look at things like tariffs, that would impact the entire auto sector. And that obviously would have an impact on the U.S. economy. So we want to make sure that we engage in a very productive dialogue with the policymakers on this.
Well, and I just want to correct Maria Elena. I think I just lost Mark's job. He's the current CEO of Ford. But your thoughts on that? What is really true here?
Well, it seems like what Donald Trump is trying to do is tell his constituency, the people that voted for him, look, I'm keeping my promises. I told you that I would do everything to avoid jobs going over to Mexico, specifically Mexico. So he wants to take credit for that, and that's why he's doing it. But, you know, we have to be very careful with things like this. When he says that he's going to dismantle NAFTA, we have to think also of how the U.S. benefits from imports from Mexico. For example, they import a lot of the parts that make some of these cars. They import, Mexico is the number two supplier of agricultural products from Mexico. to the U.S. And, you know, it would definitely affect workers here, would affect prices here. If Donald Trump plans to deport undocumented immigrants, many of which work in the agricultural industry, and then tries to break NAFTA, and we lose some of those imports from Mexico, or tariffs raise on these products, we're going to see a problem in this country.
Yeah. Well, we got lots more to talk about, but I guess just, Rick, your thoughts about going ahead. And let's bring in the Democrats. What happens? Does Nancy Pelosi get her leadership position? What happens?
The Democrats are in disarray in trying to figure this out. And I think there's a good chance that she gets ousted. I think she still is the front runner to keep that position. But they need an identity. They got beaten very badly last week, and it's forcing them to reexamine what they stand for. And there's a lot of voices saying it's time for new voices, a younger generation of Democrats to try to lead them forward.
If I can add to that,
yeah, just a couple seconds.
Democrats need to do some soul searching because they need to try to figure out why they allowed Donald Trump to steal their message. They're supposed to be the party of underprivilege, yet the narrative of Trump's campaign was directed at those who are expected to be protected by Democrats.
Well, Maria Elena Salinas, news anchor at Univision, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Rick Klein, political director at ABC News, thank you also.
Thank you.
Thanksgiving is less than a week away. Unbelievable. Did you know that when the Pilgrims first came to this continent, they were headed for Virginia, but stopped at Plymouth Rock because they ran out of beer? That in the 1600s, Harvard had its own brewery, and as a result, early lectures were almost unintelligible. Alcohol was used to pacify slaves and Indians. American children once started the day with a flip, a combination of grain, alcohol, and fruit juice. In fact, as Susan Cheever wrote in her 2015 book, Drinking in America, alcohol is one of the most powerful forces in American history. The book came out recently in paperback. We spoke with Susan when Drinking in America was first published, a time when a number of books about family alcoholism had been published, and Susan Cheever wanted to differentiate between a family's response to alcohol and America's response.
When a nation has alcoholic tendencies, it is different from a family because throughout American history, there's often been a drink at the crossroads, which changes what happens. And that's my thesis. But as a national history, our drinking doesn't always have bad results at all. I'm not sure that the American Revolution would have happened had the Sons of Liberty not been meeting in the basement of the Green Dragon Tavern.
And drinking. And by the way, Ethan Allen, who led them, died of alcoholism.
But first, he almost single-handedly took over Fort Ticonderoga, a heavily defended fort, and used those cannons to win the Battle of Bunker Hill. You know, he took really insane risks, the kind of risks that people take when they're drinking. So in many ways, American history has been affected positively by drinking as well as negatively. So that's the difference between a nation and a family, I think.
Well, and also it was a part of your family. You've been very open about this, about your alcoholism, about your father, writer John Cheever's alcoholism and his sobriety. You wrote a book about the founder of AA. I was surprised to learn that there was an earlier attempt at AA, men who would meet together.
That's the Washingtonians. They were in Baltimore, and actually Abraham Lincoln was a big fan of the Washingtonians. And they discovered many, many things that Bill Wilson later rediscovered or discovered. He knew about them, certainly. But they discovered that it was very helpful to have a bunch of people if you were trying to stop drinking who were also trying to stop drinking. They discovered that it was very helpful not to tell people what to do, but rather to demonstrate what they had done. So in many ways, it was a precursor to Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah. So you quote others who have taken a deep look at alcoholism in America, including Eric Burns, who writes that it was America's first national pastime way before baseball. Let's just start with those who came over on the Mayflower. It was dangerous to drink water back then. That's partly why they were so drunk all the time drinking beer.
So it was a gallon a day of 0.6 beer for every man, woman, and child over 12.
And it's interesting, you point out the Pilgrims and the Puritans who followed them were against drunkenness, but the tavern was a sacred place.
The tavern was at the center of every town as much as the church, more than the school. certainly for a long time, taverns were the principal government building. Everything took place in the tavern. Trials were held in the tavern. Documents were signed in the tavern. So the taverns of New England were at the center of New England life.
Yeah. Everyone drank, beginning at birth, I'm quoting you. Infants were plied with rum to help with sleep. Cider, beer, or Stonewall, rum and cider, were drunk at breakfast. You write, by the 1830s, the U.S. was the drunkest country in the world. I mean, did other people note that?
They did. Many people noted it. Many visitors from England noted it. And a visitor from France who I quote about how, you know, Americans drink to celebrate and they drink when they're sad. And the guy who says Americans drink from the crack of dawn to the crack of dawn. So, but what's interesting to me about our history in that regard is that in 1830, we were one of the drunkest countries in the world. In 1930, we outlawed drinking. Actually, in 1920. So we have this strange tension, this what I call this 100-year pendulum, where we swing one way and drink more and more and more and more, and then we swing back the other way. And those are the two sharpest poles of that in our history, but it's happening again now. In other words, after Prohibition, there was a relaxation. There was after World War II. We drank a lot, and now we're going back the other way, I think. We're raising the drinking age. We're much more aware of the bad things about that alcoholism can do to us physically. One of the points I wanted to make in this book is let's remember that it doesn't work to legislate addiction.
If you've just joined us, that's author Susan Cheever. Her new book is Drinking in America, Our Secret History. It tells of the rum-fueled American Revolution, the Whiskey Rebellion, the Civil War. General Ulysses Grant was a binge drinker, but Lincoln felt he needed him to win. In the 1900s, all five American Nobel laureates in literature were alcoholics: Sinclair Lewis, Eugene O'Neill, Faulkner, Hemingway, Steinbeck. And Susan, you mentioned the temperance movement against drinking, Prohibition. But there was no Prohibition. I mean, the president right. was serving liquor. Eleanor Roosevelt was drinking.
Right. There's that story about the mayor of Berlin who comes to New York in 1927 and says, oh, when is Prohibition going to start? It's been going for 5 years.
We're laughing, but some of the stories are just so tragic. John Adams, Abigail Adams' brother, died a horrible death of cirrhosis. Her two sons, two of her grandsons, and we're not just talking about they just calmly slip away. These were terrible deaths.
The Adams story, I think, is one of the saddest stories I know. And it makes Abigail and John, to me, it gave them a dimension of heroism that I hadn't understood before. With their two sons dying, especially Charlie, who they just adored, dying at 30, and also John Quincy Adams, you know, Emerson said John Quincy Adams acted as if he had drunk sulfuric acid for breakfast. But of course he did. Two of his beloved brothers had died and two of his sons died. It's unimaginable what that family went through because of alcoholism.
A reminder that it is a family illness and genetic, and has a genetic component.
Yes.
Lewis of Lewis and Clark.
That's a terrible story.
He had forged and found Louisiana.
Yes, he was 35 and he just could not get it together. And Jefferson liked him a lot, tried to help him, and he would get a job and lose it and get another job. Nothing interested him. Everything, well, you know, this is the last stages of alcoholism. And finally, on his way to Washington, at a kind of crummy little place on the Natchez Trace, he either killed himself or was murdered. It's still a little bit of a mystery, but since no one else was around, it was probably suicide.
Johnny Appleseed, yes, he spread apples,
right.
But it was for hard apple cider. It wasn't.
Yeah. The wonderful writer Michael Pollan is the person who noticed that since you can't really grow an edible apple from a seed, that Johnny Appleseed really wasn't about edible apples. He was really about Applejack. Pollan calls him the American Dionysius, which that's certainly not how Disney depicts him.
No. It's easy to see the line that's drawn to drinking in the 1830s when factories had two drinking breaks and they were alcoholic.
Right.
It's harder to see some of the lines that you try to draw in more recent history. You say that if the Secret Service guard for John F. Kennedy had been more alert and not hung over, they might have been more alert on that day in Dallas. And yet, when I say that, we're hearing within the last few years of the current president's Secret Service detail drinking.
Right. Well, Chief Justice Earl Warren, who was the head of the Warren Commission, the commission established to investigate the Kennedy assassination, was furious when he found out. He yelled at the head of the Secret Service, "It's Earl Warren, not me," saying, "Don't you think if they hadn't been out all night, they might have noticed the gun barrel? Don't you think if they hadn't been out all night, they might have been more alert?" So, you know, yeah. I mean, that's all I did. I just quoted him.
Right. Well, Susan Cheever, having looked at this several hundred years of history, as you said, you think the pendulum swinging back. It's not fashionable to get drunk. Nobody's having two martini lunches. But you said that you can't legislate it. What do you think can be done for people who really are in such a great deal of pain because of alcohol? What can be done?
Well, the answer is education. In other words, we can't make people's decisions for them. We can't judge people, but we can educate them. We can make sure that the decisions they do make are informed decisions. And, you know, only 10% of people who need treatment for addiction get it. 10%. So we're in the middle of a public health crisis in terms of education about alcoholism and addiction. And that's where I think all our energy should go. I don't think the answer is to pass laws saying you can't do this, you can't do that. That doesn't actually work. I think the answer is public education and
including maybe teaching this history.
Well, teaching this history, and, you know, it would be nice if we had some better numbers when it comes to addiction. But I think that the answer is very clear. People have to make their own decisions, and they have to do what they want, and they will anyway. And drinking is sometimes great, and it's sometimes tragic. But we need to give them the information that they need to make those decisions intelligently.
That's Susan Cheever. Her new book is Drinking in America, Our Secret History. It's terrific. Susan, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Get ready to tip your server at McDonald's. The fast food chain said yesterday that it's getting ready to offer table service at all of its U.S. restaurants. And it's just one of the many adjustments the company is making to help turn around sales. Mike Regan is a columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly, and he joins us now from New York. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, Magna.
So, Mike, I have to say one of my fondest memories growing up in Corvallis, Oregon, is riding my bike through the McDonald's drive-thru. So this idea of table service at McDonald's, how's that going to work?
Well, you know, you'll basically have the option to sit down and get table service, but you'll still be able to order at the counter and the drive-thru. I don't know about bikes, if they'll allow that, but the drive-thru is actually where the majority of their sales come from. So this table service plan is part of a sort of a broader strategy aimed at improving the experience inside the actual restaurants to beef up sales there. No pun intended.
Okay. We'll try to resist. But it's not just table service, since, as you said, there will be these other options still available. But the company is going to be opening up digital kiosks that people can order from. So would that be before you got to the head of the line?
Yes, they'll be installing these kiosks. They've found that people actually might spend a little more if they have the time to go through the kiosk. And they'll also be offering the option of you can order and pay for your meal over a smartphone app before you even get into the restaurant. So it's all part of a plan to really streamline the process and make it more efficient so that people are not discouraged by the prospect of big lines once they enter the restaurant.
So this is a direction which several companies are moving towards. I mean, Starbucks has got it, Panera's got it, and others. I mean, what's going on in the industry? But with McDonald's, we're talking about fast food. That's really driving these changes.
Right. Well, specifically at McDonald's, Steve Easterbrook, the CEO for the last year and a half, has shown a real eagerness to shake things up and experiment, try new things, and specifically because they are facing a lot of new competition. For one thing, people are tending to eat healthier and sort of more gourmet-oriented these days. But even if you're just hungry for a burger, there's a lot more competition from chains like Shake Shack and Five Guys and various regional chains. So much stiffer competition than McDonald's has faced in the past.
And McDonald's has been trying to jumpstart sales recently. I mean, lots of people got excited when they introduced all-day breakfast. However, shares are up just over, 1% in 2016 so far? That's lagging way behind the S&P. So, I mean, why is it that even with these changes, McDonald's seems to have a mountain to climb here?
For one thing, they've just grown to be such a big chain that trying to move the needle on something that big is difficult. And again, they're experimenting. Some of their changes have done well. The introduction of all-day breakfast, a lot of people like that. That's here to stay. Another big ambitious program they had was called Create Your Own Taste, in which people could order a burger with various different toppings and different types of bun and that sort of thing. And that didn't work out so well because it was kind of too much for the franchises to handle. It cost more to provide all these ingredients, and it was more labor intensive.
Yeah. Well, Mike Regan is a columnist for a Bloomberg Gadfly, and Mike, I have to say, the folks that used to work at my local McDonald's were pretty cool. They never minded when I rode my bike through the drive-thru.
I'll have to try that sometime.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you.
Several miles off the coast of the New Hampshire-Maine border, there's a place called Star Island. And if you ever have a chance to go there, here's what you would see.
You would see just a giant expanse of sea and sky. That would be the first thing that would strike you.
This is Alexandra De Steiger. For the past 20 years, she's been Star Island's solo winter caretaker.
The island itself is rather bare. It's very scrubby, a lot of rocks, a lot of big ledges. And then on one portion of the island, there's the big old hotel. So it sort of looms up out of the rock. It has this sense of the past. It's all, most of the buildings are very old, including the hotel. So it feels like you've been dropped not only in place, but in time. It's so quiet. That's the other thing about the island is there's no modern noise. There's no noise of any kind other than the ocean, the surf, and the lighthouse horn. Sometimes the bell buoy ringing when the seas get big. But other than that, it's extremely quiet.
De Steiger winters alone on Star Island. She has an internet connection, if she wants it. She also has her camera. Her ghostly beautiful seascapes and landscapes are collected in the book Small Island, Big Picture, Winters of Solitude, Teach an Artist to See. Alexandra De Steiger is also an accomplished sailor, so she says the splendid, frost-bitten solitude of a Star Island winter was a natural fit.
I was always attracted by the ocean. I wanted to go to sea, even as a young person, so when I was 18, I shipped out on my first ship. It was a tall ship out of Gloucester, Massachusetts, the Regina Maris. And I ended up being a sailor for about, I guess, 9 years on long sea voyages. And then I was visiting a shipmate who was working on Appledore Island, one of the Isles of Shoals. And he said, you know, you should come out, see the Isles of Shoals, they're gorgeous. And I lived in New Hampshire, so I'd never been. And it just so happened that they were looking for a caretaker over on Star Island. And we went over, and I was interviewed, and they hired
me. You were interviewed. What were they looking for in a caretaker?
They were looking for someone who could live remotely and who understood, you know, things about generators and the wind. You know, being a sailor, it was kind of a perfect fit because, you know, I knew how bad storms could be.
So you're there all winter long,
yeah.
Off the grid, as you said. What do you do for food, for running water?
There's a cistern under the building that I live in, and so I collect rainwater off the roof. Sometimes I'll run out of water, and I have to pump it from the well, which is across the other side of the island. So that could be a bit of a hassle in winter because everything freezes quickly. But for food, my partner Brad visits, and he comes and brings food. So I'll email him a big list of groceries, and he'll bring it out.
So you're the only person on the island all winter long?
Yes. Well, I'm the only person on all nine of the islands. There's nine, and they all become deserted.
And how do you revel in that solitude? I mean, how do you deal with it?
I love solitude. I just it feels like I have this whole wild enclave to myself. And I think as an artist, I get a lot out of solitude because there's a centering that happens when you're alone. You know, when you're with someone, there's always this distraction of, you know, are they enjoying themselves? But when you're alone, there's no one to interact with but yourself. So it's a way to just become quiet and to center on what's around you.
On the other hand, though, I'm curious, you're on an island by yourself. Have there ever been any wild moments that were frightening?
Yeah, the storms out there can be very severe. So there was one year where there was a 91-mile-an-hour storm, and I was there alone, and I was I stayed inside because with the big old buildings, often the roofing tiles will fly off and parts of the building will blow away. But even inside, it's scary because the whole house vibrates and the window glass just bows inward and you could see it. It almost looks like it's breathing. There was another storm, too, where a door on the near the hotel roof had blown in half. It just ripped in half. And so I went up with a piece of plywood. This was after the storm, but it was still quite windy. And I got up there on the roof with this plywood. And I realized that the roof itself was a sheet of ice. It was a flat portion of the hotel roof. And so being a sailor, this was really fun for me. I was able to just angle that plywood. And I sailed myself across that roof. And I set that piece of plywood up against that door. And the wind held it in place. And I was able to screw it there.
A plywood spinnaker. Like, who would have thought?
Yeah, that worked out really well.
Now, we have to talk about the fact that you're an artist as well, and you're a photographer, and I've seen some of the pictures that you've taken on the island, and they are so beautiful.
Thank you.
So can you tell me about how looking through the lens of your camera and that way of seeing, what do you see around the island when you're doing that?
I guess the way I go about it is when I go out to photograph, I don't think about photographing. What I'll do instead is what's more natural to me, which is to just go out and sit on the rocks and wander about and thoroughly enjoy being there. And then taking pictures is almost an afterthought, you know, of just the sheer enjoyment of the experience. So then making images becomes a way to participate further with that enjoyment.
Well, I was thinking about the title of your book, right? Which is Small Island, Big Picture, Winters of Solitude, Teach an Artist to See.
When I first arrived, you know, everything is new. And when you're in a new place, it's exciting to take pictures of everything because you've not seen anything before. And that's how it was for me. But then after a few years, I realized that, you know, this is a very small place and there's only so many things here to photograph. And I was a little worried that would become limiting. And then slowly I realized it was not limiting at all because there's always more to see. If you sit quietly in a spot, these subtle things that you never would have noticed start to stand out.
So I guess on that note, let me just ask you, you're going out for your 20th winter on Star Island. What's the first thing you're going to do? What's the first thing you usually do?
The first thing I will do, I think, is head out to the rocks on the east side where the ledges are high, and I'll probably stand there and I'll just soak it all in and prepare myself for another long winter alone.
Alexandra De Steiger is a photographer and winter caretaker of Star Island. Alexandra, thank you so much, so very much for speaking with us, and I hope you have a great winter out there.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
Well, she could be the one person missing the hashtag mannequin challenge. Have you seen this? People posing frozen mid-move. There's Beyonce catching a beach ball, Michelle Obama taking selfies with the Cleveland Cavaliers, then posting videos, usually with the music of the rap duo Ray Shrimnard's Black Beatles. Their mannequin challenge froze an entire audience. That girl is a real proud Sarah Bellman wrote about all of this for Vice. Sarah, it started in October with teens Jasmine Cavins and Emily Allen in Jacksonville, Florida. We were going to speak with them, but they had class, bless them. So tell us more.
Well, their video pretty much started off as a grassroots movement. It was on social media. They were just in class with some of their friends and just posing, doing what you would normally do with friends. It was pretty entertaining. They started the hashtag, wanted people to join in on the fun, and then more and more people decided to take the mannequin challenge.
No kidding, it's a brush fire. They used the music American Authors, which we're listening to, Best Day of My Life, but as we said, it sort of moved on. And now there's an offshoot. There's the hashtag Andy's coming. Remember in the film Toy Story, Woody yells out when the boy Andy would come back in the bedroom, Andy's coming, and all the toys would fall. And now people are doing that, falling all over the place here on a basketball court. This was posted online by Sean.dude.
Andy's coming!
What are you seeing with Andy's coming?
I think Andy's coming is just another way to have this viral type of experience that people really want to be a part of. It, is part of a community of social media. And along with Andy's challenge, there is now a more political version of this, which is called Trump's Challenge, which is when people are, you know, in their natural habitat. Someone comes in, yells, "Trump's coming," and everyone flees. So it's kind of a fun take on the recent political climate that we're in right now.
Well, of course, if the other side had won, there'd probably be a corresponding Hillary's coming as well. We'll post all of these videos at hearandnow.org. Sarah Bellman, entertainment reporter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, and no, Meghna, we haven't done ours. It's like we're like too tired or something.
I feel like a mannequin's more animate than I am right now.
That's right. So maybe we'll work on it this afternoon. You're listening. But send us yours. Actually, send us yours at hearandnow.org.
During the campaign, Donald Trump promised he'd bring back jobs to America's coal country. He won big there, especially in West Virginia. So what do voters there think now that Trump is president-elect? Well, Ken Ward Jr. is a reporter at the Charleston Gazette-Mail, where he writes the blog Coal Tattoo, and he joins us. Ken, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thank you.
Well, Ken, I wonder if you could first start us off with one of your most recent posts that you put on the Coal Tattoo blog about sort of a roundup of what people are saying in coal country after the election of Donald Trump. You quoted some papers in Kentucky. What's being said?
There was a story out of Kentucky where Senator Mitch McConnell, of course, is a strong supporter of the coal industry, was basically kind of admitting that even with the election of Donald Trump, no one really knew whether the coal industry in eastern Kentucky and southern West Virginia and Appalachia would really rebound. And this despite Donald Trump very clearly saying during his campaign that he was going to bring the miners' jobs back and get the miners back to work.
Well, Ken, there's also this interesting excerpt that you highlighted that came from the Herald Leader, where the interim president of the Kentucky Coal Association, his name is Nick Carter. In fact, he told them he would not expect to see a lot of growth because of a Trump presidency. I mean, can you tell us more about that?
The head of the West Virginia Coal Association had this pretty wild kind of idea that West Virginia coal production within a year or so would be back up over 120 million tons, which is more than West Virginia has produced in any year since 2012. And it's something like twice what most of the projections from industry experts are calling for, even if you consider the repeal of some of the Obama administration regulations like the Clean Power Plan. You know, no one is really in their right mind suggesting that kind of an increase in coal production here. And so what you have is a situation where a segment of voters, the coal miners and their families, were told one thing, that, hey, we're going to bring all these jobs back, when really everyone who was saying that at the time knew that it was wildly optimistic and was unlikely to happen.
Mm. So I wonder, though, I mean, it's early days yet, right? The election was just last week, but President-elect Trump won West Virginia handily, every county, almost 70% of the vote. Do you have a sense as to how, you know, his supporters or the coal industry, coal workers in general, reacting to these sort of early hints as to what may or may not be possible in terms of growing their jobs and the economy in the state?
What I see, for example, in the comments on my blog about this is people in the coal industry are still very insistent that, well, if we can just get the boot of the EPA off of our necks, you know, who knows what might happen. And there's this kind of hope among some people that, well, there might be another boom just around the corner, and whereas really most of the experts just don't really see that happening.
Mm. Well, you've written that part of the reason, these are your words, that so many West Virginians threw in with Trump is that the West Virginia that's in front of their eyes doesn't necessarily look that familiar to them, and really the country may not look or feel that familiar to them anymore. What are you trying to get at there?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is, it is true that places like southern West Virginia and eastern Kentucky are not as diverse in a lot of ways as many other parts of the country are becoming. But at the same time, what people see in front of them here with, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 coal jobs in southern West Virginia disappearing in a very short period of time, and all of the struggles that some of these communities have with opioid abuse and drug problems, it's not the thriving communities that some of these voters recall from days when coal was doing better. And, you know, the Obama administration has done a lot of things to improve the national economy. But places like southern West Virginia and eastern Kentucky, a lot of people don't see those kind of improvements and, in fact, aren't sharing in those kind of improvements.
Well, finally, Ken, I wonder if I can ask, there's something that you wrote that really stopped me in my tracks because, I mean, this is your part of the country and you know it and you love it and you're committed to it. I mean, you wrote in a blog post that, quote, the West Virginia that embraces so much fear and hatred isn't the one I grew up in and continue to try to make a life in and help in some small way to improve. I just don't recognize it.
West Virginians that I know are a kind and loving people. And I and lots of other people, I think, struggle with understanding how people that show that much care for their neighbors could embrace a candidate that expresses ideas like, you know, rounding up people because of their religion. And I read someone somewhere said that, you know, everyone who voted for Trump isn't a racist, but for people who voted with Trump, racism wasn't a deal breaker. And it's difficult to understand a situation if you don't try to look in the other from the other person's perspective. And for folks in southern West Virginia, there is a sense of desperation about their economic situation that puts them in a position where they are maybe willing to overlook things that normally I don't think they would overlook.
Well, Ken Ward Jr. is a reporter at the Charleston Gazette-Mail in West Virginia. He also writes the blog Coal Tattoo. Ken, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.